Dark Wreath Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn semester 2009, this is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 7. Lecture 6, delivered on September 3, 2009. The title of this lecture is The Federal Reserve and the Interest Rate Environment.
Today, the Federal Reserve and the Interest Rate Environment. This lecture presupposes a certain level of knowledge of supply and demand dynamics. However, I will try to cover as much as I can, not to assume much more than I absolutely have to about your knowledge of economics and also your knowledge of the Federal Reserve System. Here's the thing. I'm working this lecture has a trajectory. I'm aiming at what happens to interest rates when the Federal Reserve gets involved. And the Federal Reserve is the 800-pound gorilla driving interest rates. If I am to think of a project that a company undertakes as essentially the same as a security, in the sense that a project is a claim on future expected cash flows, if it is a project that a company undertakes is a security, I showed you last week how interest rates drive prices of securities. As a price of a security rises, its yield falls. As the price of a security falls, its yield rises. That was that basic exercise with a one-year T-bill. It applies to all securities, holding other things constant. So here's the deal. In our business life, when interest rates go up, the value of our projects goes down, all other things being equal. If the value of a project is the present value of the net expected future cash flows, when interest rates go up, our projects go down in value. When interest rates go down, our projects elevate in value. So we really do care a whole lot about the interest rate environment. Rising interest rates generally, with all other things being held constant, mean lowering values of our assets if those values are determined by what we expect them to bring in the future to us. So that means that we care deeply about interest rates. Not just interest rates, but the driving forces of interest rates. And not just the driving forces of interest rates, we care about knowing what the future looks like. As I told you before, the best way to predict the future is not to look at history. The best way to predict the future is to help create it. You're going to be the citizens of the world. You're going to be the global citizens, the world business people. You damn well better be, all the energy I'm putting into you. Okay, so I want you to understand these things, not like someone who winks and says, you betcha, not someone who says, capitalism sucks, man. I want you to understand underneath what is driving the world, what is actually moving us, instead of the simple, stupid stuff that is mouthed by the media and the pundits. I want you to know what's really going on behind the scenes and then make informed decisions as business people about accepting projects, rejecting projects, about business opportunities, your prospects as an employee, what are your best job prospects, but also how do you command the world as leaders. So here we go. I'm going to begin with a few scattered ideas. And I assume that you have been shown this in economics, but I think you should see it again. It turns out that you happen to be the illegitimate son of Bill Gates. It was a dark, ugly night, and it was Decatur, and Bill was lonely, and you were the love child of Bill Gates and a Decatur woman. Now, he is on his deathbed and he feels bad about not ever communicating with you. So he has one of his 5,000 lawyers cut you a check for $1,000. That'll make up for the years. You get this check and you say, wow, I have a check for $1,000. So I shall go to my bank and I shall deposit it. You deposit it with me. I'm your banker. You're crazy if you would put $1,000. Oh, never mind. $1,000 you're going to put in the bank. And that's your deposit. Now, the way our banking system works, no bank in its right mind is going to put that $1,000 in the vault. I'm not going to put that $1,000 in and say, well, we'll wait for him to come back and clean that someday. No. I want to earn something on that. I want to put that money to work. I would like to lend it out. Well, I would love to lend all 1,000 of it out, but I'm a little skittish about that. And besides, there's this regulatory body that says I have to keep some of it in the vault. That some of it we will call the required reserve. Now, let's say that the required reserve ratio is 0.20. In other words, 20% of any demand deposit, a deposit that could be demanded on the spot, in other words, 20% of any demand deposit I have to keep, just in case people come in, they need some money. So I shall keep 20% of that, which means that in the vault I'll put 200, and then I have $800 of lendable money I could actually lend out. And you come to me, sir, and say, I should like to start a business. Well, how much? $800 is what I need. What kind of a business? I want to start a Swedish massage parlor called Rolf's. Your name is Rolf? No, but I can pretend I have a Swedish accent. Really? Yes, my name is Rolf. My muscles ripple, ripple, ripple. See? Not bad. I'll lend you $800. So I lend him $800, and he pays you. You build Swedish massage parlors. Indeed, you are internationally known outside of Sweden. They use real Swedish contractors. But you build it. So I lend you the money. You give it to him. You pay him. He comes back to me. I'm the banker. He's got a bank account with me. He deposits the $800 with me. Yes, indeed. He puts the $800 in my bank. Okay, now I've got this $800, and I'm going to have to keep a fraction of it. 20% is what this regulatory agency that oversees my bank and scares the pants off me every time they come in. Well, I'll 20% of it, that's $160. So I do have $640 to lend. Now, you come to me and you say, I should like to borrow $640 to start my business. What kind of a business? I want to start a male gigolo business. I say, indeed, do you know Rolf? Yes, Rolf is going to be my referring agent. Sweet. Here's $640. So I lend you $640, and then you go out and hire someone to set up your business with a PBX line and the operator's phones and 24-hour hotline. And you do that. You are experienced in setting up these kinds of phone systems and call-in centers and emergency hotlines. And so you pay him the $640. Well, you've got an account with me too, so you deposit the $640 in my bank. Whoa, wait. Let's stop. Look what's happened to the money supply. The money supply is expanding on its own. My bank has started with $1,000. In just three rounds, that $1,000 has gone to, what the hell is that? $2,440. Look at that. The money supply is expanding on its own. So, well, I could do this all day, get down to the pennies and add it up. It turns out that it will actually come out to be the total expansion of the money supply from just that one autonomous punch of $1,000 will be $5,000. How do I know that? Well, it's just 1 over the required reserve ratio. It's a math thing. We call that the money multiplier. It's driven by the required reserve ratio. Notice that as that required reserve ratio goes down, the money multiplier goes up. So if this regulatory body that I was talking about that sets the required reserve ratio wanted to speed up the creation of money, it could lower the money the required reserve ratio, and it would have that effect. Conversely, if the regulatory authority wanted to slow down the creation of money, it could raise the required reserve ratio, which would reduce the money multiplier. But either way, whoever sets that required reserve ratio has an extraordinary power over the creation of money in a fractional reserve banking system. An enormous power. This is a blunt instrument. Now, to be perfectly honest with you, the real one is a little bit more complicated. The formula is not much, but we do know that people actually do not put all of the money they get in their get into the bank. They keep a little bit in their pocket. We call that a cash balance, and that tends to blunt the effect. The actual money multiplier is 1 plus K over K plus RRR, where the K is the percentage of any money you've got that you keep in your pocket. See, because if you keep it in your pocket, it doesn't go into this money multiplier spinning machine. So the real money multiplier is that 1 plus K over K plus RRR. Okay, look, I'm not going to ask you, I'm not going to test you, what is a money multiplier? That's not the purpose of a finance course. That's an economics question. But I do want you to understand that this is one of the tools of a regulatory authority that would have control over the money supply and its growth. By elevating, in other words, this is like a blunt throttle, and it is blunt. The truth of the matter is this thing playing with RRR too much, too often, can cause a real whipsaw in the expansion and contraction of the money supply. You don't want to play with it too much. You do want to watch it, though. Look, the point of a required reserve for a bank is so that the bank has money in the vault if people come in and want their money. If we had a time when people were really, really worried about their banks or really worried about the world around them, we would probably want to lift that RRR up, because we would be concerned that people would be running to their banks, and we don't want anyone to be running to a bank and the bank not have the money. So in times when people aren't as sure of the banking system, or people in a large sense are not feeling very safe, we would probably have RRR higher. And then in a time of big economic growth, people are very secure, they believe in their banks a lot, we'd put this required reserve ratio a lot lower. Real world, in the theoretical sense, when I teach this stuff, I use money multipliers of 5, 10. Those are nice ones. And right now, strangely enough, data that's been collected point to a money multiplier, an actual real-world money multiplier of, I guess, around, in the United States, around 2.3 right now. That's actually surprisingly low. So this tool isn't actually doing very strong right now. At a money multiplier of 2.3, you're not getting a whole lot of punch. When you put money in, just throw money in, the expansion is not what we would have in a more normal time, where you get a factor of 5, a factor of 7.5, maybe even a factor of 10. Now, it's not all that strong that the punch isn't. At 2.3, that's not a whole lot. That's not too impressive. But that's the money multiplier effect. Now the next thing, that I'll bring up is the idea of signaling. Signaling in finance has great meaning. We are always looking for market signals. It may be, in a sense, reading tea leaves. For example, you're coming to class one day, sir, and you see me running out of the building screaming, "Aah!" That's a signal. It might influence your decision about whether or not to go into the building. Okay? This building is haunted. I tell you, at night, this building actually makes me feel heebie-jeebies. Suppose you open the door and a voice said, "Go out!" FTS. That's what I'd say. And that's a fancy that scenario. I will leave. Whatever it is. Yeah, dude, it's yours. No problem. You know, I fail. So you see, that's a signal. Okay, these are signals. You meet a gorgeous woman at a bar. She's just beautiful. And you walk up to her and you say, "Can I buy you a drink?" And she looks at you and she says, "Why, yes." Again, FTS. There's a point to this, trust me. Real finance for real people. There's a point to what I'm doing here. You see, we are always looking for signals. And regulators know this. And good regulators understand the importance of signaling the markets. You don't want regulators who bluff you, who lie to you. We don't like that. Business people don't like that. It takes away our trust. We really don't hate regulators. To a certain extent, we want a regulatory environment. We want it to be stable. We want it to be fair. And we want it to be transparent. And one of the things about transparency is, even though maybe a regulator can't tell us exactly what its purpose or intentions are, we certainly want the regulators to tell us, as best they can, what their thinking is. So if I had a regulator of the monetary system, of money, of banking, who could send me a signal about what it wanted to have happen with interest rates, if it felt that interest rates were too low and it wanted to raise them, or if it felt that interest rates were too high and it wanted to lower them, or if it felt that the interest rate environment was good and it wanted to keep it that way. If we could have a regulatory structure that gave the regulators the ability to signal us about what their sentiments were, that would be very good. That would be desirable. We have that. Okay, that's the second part. The money multiplier was the first part. The other one was the signaling effect. And then there's a third part that I will have to just get to when I get to it. Our Federal Reserve System, it was established by the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. 13? Yeah, I think it was 13. No, I wasn't alive then, for God's sake. Stop it. But the Federal Reserve System was established by an act of Congress. Now, there's always been, ever since then, a sort of a right-wing conspiracy theory that goes something like, well, this is all wrong because this Federal Reserve System controls the money supply. But the Constitution itself says, and it does, that the money will be controlled by Congress. So this is unconstitutional. Well, actually, maybe it is, but it has passed Supreme Court muster. So once the Supreme Court reviews and makes a decision, that's what we call constitutional law. So constitutional law validates this Federal Reserve System. So even though you could hear, well, it's not a right system, it's against the Constitution, no. Constitutional law has had the final word. Our Federal Reserve System is okay. Here's how it works. The Federal Reserve System is divided into our banking system geographically is divided into 12 regions. 12 regions. Now, the regions towards the east are very small compared to the regions in the west, because when this was established, there was hardly anyone living out west. Unfortunately, things have changed now, so those districts out west that are huge have huge responsibilities, because a lot of people have moved west. Now they're sorry they did, the way California's suffering. But anyway, that's another story. But each of these regions has a Federal Reserve Bank. You'll hear me sometimes call it a district bank, that oversees all the banks, pretty much all the banks in the region. The banks that aren't state chartered, but even there, the Fed's trying to get its mojo on about that. But so these 12 regions oversee all the banks in the country. Every region oversees its banks. Now, interestingly enough, by the way, I believe almost all of the Federal Reserve district banks have branches through the region. Maybe a couple, maybe more than a couple. So you might see a branch of the Federal Reserve Bank that oversees this region somewhere other than at the center of the region, at the nexus of the region. Look, here we are right on a boundary between the Chicago region and the St. Louis region. And were you told, let me find this out, which one are we overseen by, the Chicago region or the St. Louis region? Yeah, we're the Chicago. We're just barely, actually it's not that far to the south before you see the banks under the control of the St. Louis Fed. But we're in the Chicago. Now, I would recommend that if you ever get a chance, the St. Louis Fed does give tours. Now, you'd think, well, that's the lamest ass tour I've ever heard of. Actually, it used to be fun. It's not quite as fun now because they've got the security craze. They've got guys with automatic weapons and all that. But even now, you can get a decent tour. They'll even give you a bag of shredded money. A little bag. Don't try to glue it back together, for God's sake. But they'll give you a bag of shredded money and all that. You can get some nice a coffee cup that says Federal Reserve System, makes it look like you work there. And this is one of the things that I tell people, if you're going to major in something, major in economics and finance, do a double, because you can be hired by the Fed. Some of my fellow PhD students, even students who never made it past their master's or bachelor's degrees, are working for the Fed. They're making so much more money than me that it makes me want to vomit. But you get a chance to see it. It's a very interesting place, and it also gives you a sense if maybe this would be a kind of a place that you would want to work, because they do hire finance, economics, management, accounting people. And you're in sort of like the government, but you're in a semi-autonomous part of the government. Right now, the Federal Reserve is just pissing its brains out because for the first time in history, there's actually a serious talk about auditing the Fed. The Fed has never been audited, really. And, oh, God, that's funny, because think about that. Work for a federal agency, something that's part of the federal government, that has never been audited? Sweet. But anyway, enough of that. At the center of the Fed is the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. This is seven big dogs. The biggest of the big dogs is the chairman. He is one of the seven governors. The governors are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. They are, in that sense, autonomous. They are not subject to popular vote, to the ignorance of the masses. They're not subject to Congress. They can be brought before Congress, and the congressmen can yell at them and strut in front of the cameras at them, but the congressmen can't really do anything to them. They are very powerful people. Historically, the Board of Governors has comprised some of the best in this country. Just men and women who are just absolutely perfect. They no traffic tickets. I don't think they are even allowed to have sex. But talk to them. You'll find out. You'll see what I mean. Recent years, the Fed has lost some of that cream of the crop of it. We've got, as a matter of fact, I just had a fit. The last governor that was appointed to the board of the Fed, she had run a community bank for a couple of years until it was bought out by a bigger bank that kicked her out, gave her a bunch of stock, and said, we don't want you around it. But her actual history as a worker, most of her life she had been a dinner theater actress, which is really, really scary as hell to me. That one of the seven governors is a dinner theater actress, and some of the others are really questionable resumes too. But we'll set that aside. The seven governors are the head. Here are the three roles of the Federal Reserve. The three roles of the Federal Reserve, and we call it the Fed. Role one is that it regulates and supervises the banking system of the country. It regulates and supervises. The Board of Governors regulates. It creates the regulations consistent with law and consistent with sound financial practices by banks. Supervision is then in the hands of each of the regional banks, the reserve banks. They take the regulations established at the Board of Governors level, and then they articulate those in regulation, in supervision of the banks in their region. You follow how it works? The board makes the regulations. The reserve banks then enforce those regulations upon the banks under their charge. That's how it works in our Federal Reserve System. Now, I'm going to go into a bitch session just briefly. At the center of the crisis, the collapse of our banking system because of irresponsible banking practices, were the banks in New York, under the supervision of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, often called the Empire Bank. Now, who was the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York until just recently? Timothy Geithner, who was just appointed recently as the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States. That is unbelievable irresponsibility. Now, don't get me wrong, Obama is a good president, and I support him, but he's a dumbass for appointing that man. That was an objective statement there, you understand. Serious analysis went into that. You don't put a hoe handle like that into a position of greater power when he has failed as the New York president of the New York Bank. I got that thing pain going up my arm again. Okay. Anyway. Regulates and supervise. Two. The Federal Reserve, and this one is really cool. I'm about to write a brief article about this because there's something underneath that I'll tell you about. The Federal Reserve serves as a bank for banks. You need a bank, place to deposit your money, place to clear your checks, a place where you can steal pens if they're not attached. You need a bank. Banks need a bank too. They need a bank doesn't write checks on itself. You wouldn't that'd be crazy to do that. Well, actually, that'd be kind of cool. I ought to try that. The Bank of Professor C. Yeah, hey, stop it. You see, banks actually have to have their own bank. So the Federal Reserve serves as a bank to provide commercial services to banks. But it isn't the only one that does it. It, by law, is just one competitor. There are private banks that offer bank-for-bank services. So the Federal Reserve is a competitor in the market for offering commercial services to banks. So in other words, what that means is that banks have a public option. You heard about talk about, you know, we can't have the government offering a public option in healthcare. That'd be just socialism, wouldn't it? The Federal Reserve has been doing this for almost a century, offering a public option. Banks can go to private companies to do their banking, or they can go to the Fed to do their banking. just like is being described in the healthcare legislation. You can have your own private insurance or you can buy healthcare insurance from the government. It's the same thing. And yet it's socialism. They're pissing all over themselves that it's socialism. It's, well, whether or not it is, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying let's go with this healthcare reform. But the idea that somehow this is some new radical socialist thing that had never been done in the United States before, we do it all the time. To the tune, in the commercial banking sector, you're talking tens of billions of dollars. And by the way, it's profitable for the Fed. The Fed does it soundly. It is not a money-losing effort. Now, the reason that the Federal Reserve does this and the legislation was, first of all, to just foster competition. You don't want commercial services doing this and just jacking up their prices and screwing banks over on checking fees like they do us. We don't want banks to suffer like we do. So this offers competition to the private commercial banks that provide banking services to banks, but it also encourages technological innovation because the Fed's got just lots of technological know-how and they can bring the latest technology to bear in banking services. So what this does is it forces the commercial banks that offer banking services for banks to do the same thing, to keep pushing their technological curve forward. And it works. It really does work. Now, I saw an article just a couple of, about last week, that right now the Fed provides, and this came from the Empire Bank, about 35 to 40% of check clearing services for banks in the United States, which would mean maybe about 60 to 65% is being provided by the private firms that do provide commercial services to banks. So it's not like the Fed is controlling the market, owns the market. It is a balanced market between the Fed and the private companies that do the same thing. And again, as I said, if there's anything that the Fed does right, this is it. Of the three that I'm going to show you, this is the one the Fed does quite well. It has done it for a long time, and it really has fostered competition and technological innovations in commercial banking services provided to banks. Okay, now, finally we get to the third one, the third of the three roles of the Fed. This is where we're beginning to start to turn the swirling down on the focus. The Federal Reserve conducts monetary policy. It controls the money supply. It, and I want to emphasize this, it controls the money supply. That's its responsibility. It has the authority. And unfortunately, I cannot say that it has adequate accountability. If you have read The Federal Reserve Under Fire, parts 1 and 2. You will see, you know what happened. Here we go. Look. Couple of basics. When I use the word money, you know money when you see it. I know money when I see it. But unfortunately, there's money, you could look right at it, and you wouldn't know that's money. There is money that could actually bite you in the ass, and you might go to the neighbor and say, your dog bit me in the ass. No, that was M3 that bit you in the ass. It was what? No, it was a dog. No, it was M3. Don't tell me that. I don't know what M3 is. I didn't see M3. No, you don't. You have never seen M3. I promise you, not one of you has ever seen an M3 type of money, and you probably won't ever. You will never go to Wendy's and order a double cheeseburger, extra ketchup and mustard, and pay for it with M3 money. You won't. It just, I know that for a fact that it won't happen. Not because you're a loser, not because you are never going to make a lot of money, it's just because you can't use M3. First of all, M3, I don't think, I have to be cautious about this. I don't think M3 actually physically exists. I've got to be careful. I'm using the term loosely here. Look, M0.
what the hell is in there? Oh, God. Cat must have been looking in there. This cat fur. Look. This is M0 money. Okay, look at this. I want you to look right there. See that mark right there? What is that? What is that thing right there? That's an I. That means that it was the Federal Reserve Bank that has the letter designation I of the 12 that from which this was from which this dollar originated. The Federal Reserve acts as an agent of the Treasury to print money. So if you want to steal a lot of money, you go to a Federal Reserve Bank, one of the reserve banks, okay? You won't actually steal the money because they have got so many automatic weapons that they will ventilate your hide. They won't even recognize what's left of it. But you can try. The Federal Reserve actually is where the printing is done. Ka-chung, ka-chung, ka-chung. When you go down to, if you go on the tour, you'll actually see the giant sheets of money. And do you have samples? You know, you just knock on the window. The windows are like this thick. And if you're on an official tour, some lady actually came up last time I was down there, and she had just finished doing the cutting of the money. She came on and she slapped this $100 bill. Man, that thing was pretty. It was just crisp and clean. Okay. Here's one. What does this one say? Now, can you read by any chance what it actually says around there, around the sea?
Federal Reserve Bank of the Philadelphia.
Philly! C is Philadelphia. So this came from Philadelphia. At some time in the past, it was in Philadelphia. What was the I?
Minneapolis.
This one came from Minneapolis. So essentially, you're traveling with the states in your pocket. These have been all over the place. All these dollar bills. Okay, M0, just hard cash and currency. We call it the base. Most people won't talk about the base. I got a little interested. I got a little excited about the base recently. I saw a piece of data that just sort of left my... I'm still not quite there on what I was looking at. But I'll explain that in a second here. Now, M1 is M0 and... demand deposits, checking accounts, and traveler's checks. These are all highly liquid. Now remember, liquidity is the speed with which you can convert one asset to another. The readiness with which you can convert one asset to another. All of those are very liquid. Checking accounts, demand deposits are checking accounts. If I have a check, I can demand money from your account. So please write that check very soon. Now, so these are M1 includes M0. So you'd have the cash and currency. You'd also have demand deposits and traveler's checks. Now, I'll tell you what really, I'm still not quite sure how to come to terms with this. And I haven't even looked at the data again since I saw it. A while back, I was looking at the M's, as you can tell. I keep an eye on those from the articles you read. M0 was larger than M1. And the data I kept looking at, I actually took my glasses off, my reading glasses, washed them and read it again. I still can't quite figure out how that happened. I think it was brief. I hope to God that was not something that was that was enduring. I hope it was just kind of like a blip or an accident of data. But M0 was larger than M1 for a while. You do understand how that would be a real strange-ass thing. If M0 is a subset of M1, but M1 is lower than M2, or M0, if M1 is lower than M0, that would mean that if you took M1 and subtracted out the base, the cash and currency, checking accounts and traveler's checks would account for a negative value in the economy. Nah. Whatever. That's really scary. If that was really true and it's something that wasn't just a blip, that's scary. Okay, M2. M2 includes M1, but it also includes money market mutual funds. So notice that those are a little bit less liquid. And it also includes smaller CDs. And it also includes something called negotiable order of withdrawal accounts. The first one, what the hell was the first one? Money market mutual funds. Money market accounts and money market mutual funds. I just call them money markets. It's really, there are two there, money market accounts and money market mutual funds. But just call them money markets, just sort of a lump, thinking of money markets. And then there you would have the others, smaller CDs, which of course you can get the money out, but there's a substantial interest penalty for early withdrawal. So notice the liquidity factor is lower. And then again, these negotiable order of withdrawal. Now let me ask you, do any of you have a checking account with a credit union? That's a now. That's a negotiable order of withdrawal. Technically, although you would rarely ever see this, a credit union does not have to honor one of those checks that is drawn on it, because they're not really checks. They're called drafts. They are now accounts. So even though liquidity-wise, normally you would see it, that they would honor it right on the spot, they don't have to. So we put now accounts, which the most classic example of those is credit union checking accounts. As a matter of fact, if you look at check from a credit union, I don't know if it's still true, but they actually spelled it C-H-E-Q-U-E-S at one time, just to distinguish them from C-H-E-C-K-S, which come from real banks. But that's M2. It has M1, but also has some stuff in it that's not quite as liquid. And then there is the 800-pound ginormous gorilla, the M3. That includes M2, but it also includes these monsters, euro dollars, gigantic, enormous negotiable CDs, and other highly illiquid forms of money. Now, let me try that. You look like a worldly person. You've been around, traveled, possibly been involved in CIA spy operations. Surely you have seen euro dollars. Have you ever seen a euro dollar?
No.
Believe it or not, neither have I, and I really have been around a lot. I have never seen a euro dollar. I have never had one in my pocket, because a euro dollar is actually a financial concept. It's not a physical thing. You see, at this level of money, you're talking about things that are not money like we think of money. We think normally of money in this common person's sense. The money that I'm going to use to buy my burgers tonight. The money I'm going to use possibly to write a check to pay my rent. That's what we think of as money. M3, the stuff that's in M3 that's not in M2, you're never going to see a physical object. A euro dollar is never going to walk up to you and slap you across the face. Hey, I want to be with you. Put me in your purse. Let's go eat. Won't happen, because it cannot happen. This is extraordinarily illiquid money. Now, this is the key, and I will go back in and explain why I tore my ass about the Fed. If you look at those charts, do you remember how M3 was going up like crazy? M1, the kind of money that people use, businesses, households use for their transactions, was flat, bouncing on zero. M3 was growing insanely. Banks were swimming. Banks and other financial institutions have been swimming in this M3 money. M3 can't do anything for them except sit on their balance sheets. You cannot make a bank cannot make a loan from M3. A bank cannot pay a utility bill from M3. But what it could do is use that M3 highly illiquid money to back bets. I could create an instrument that I could sell to suckers and get some real money for it. I could say it's backed by this M3 stuff. And I could do more of it and more of it. Eventually, you'll crack under that kind of doing that too much, and that's what happened. But the banks were literally generating M1 money Money just to pay big salaries, to bring money into the bank, to pay bills, to make loans. They were doing that because they were swimming in M3 and M1 wasn't growing. So how did the Fed deal with the problem of M3 growing out of control? It stopped publishing M3. That solved the problem. Yes, we have a dead body. Let's bury it. And so that's why I'm so harsh with the Fed. Well, why blame the Fed? Because the Fed is the place that controls the money supply. That is their responsibility. They have the authority. No one else has that. No other agency has that power. It is the Fed's job. So monetary policy has sucked big time. But we'll get now down to the basics, of monetary policy. Here we go. There are three tools of monetary policy. Three tools. The first of those tools is the required reserve ratio. Yes, we are coming full circle. That's that circle of life you might have heard about from the Disney movie. Don't sing it, please, for God's sake. Okay. The circle of life is coming real here. The Fed is the one who establishes the required reserve ratio. It would elevate it. It would be very unlikely to use this tool, or it should be very unlikely to use this tool to control the money supply, the growth rate, simply because it's such a blunt tool. It's also not as predictable as we might want. I mean, when the money multiplier is 2.3, that's not very cool. But you would not want to adjust the throttle too much because that might cause some problems too. What really stuns me, if you look in the book, and I saw the numbers in the book after I had checked the website of the Fed, there the required reserve ratio for the first, I think it's like for $0 to $7 million of assets of a bank, of deposits, is zero. So that's kind of shocking. They don't have to keep a reserve ratio for their first couple of mil of money in a bank. That's a little bit disturbing. And then it's actually not one ratio anymore. It's actually a tiered ratio. For larger amounts of money at the bank, above a certain threshold, there's another RRR. And then above another threshold, there is another RRR. Essentially, it's like a progressive tax system. Just like our tax system has tax tiers, there is a tiering system for banks in terms of how much reserve their reserve ratio is. And the one in the book, by the way, I should point out, is not current. I don't think, if I remember the numbers I saw at the Fed site, the one that's in the book, apparently it has changed. And I wasn't watching this, to be honest with you. I never thought about the RRR as being a tool. It was more like just something the Fed establishes it. And then if the banking system is a little shakier, they lift it up. If the banking system is more stable, then they bring it down. I never expected them to be changing it as much as it has since I was paying attention to it more in past years. Okay, B. The second tool of monetary policy is the discount rate. Now, historically, and it's kind of fun teaching now because I can actually say in another time it was different. I would have told a different story. Historically, look, the Fed can lend banks money. If a bank needs money, the Fed can lend it. And the rate at which it would go to what we call the discount window. I don't think there's actually a window. Yes, I should like a loan, I'm a bank, to the Fed. But a bank could step up to the discount window and borrow money from the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve would charge an interest rate for that money. That's the discount rate. Now, however, banks generally didn't want to borrow from the Fed. They would rather pay a slightly higher rate called the federal funds rate that is charged in the interbank lending market, where basically supply and demand forces are driving interest rates. They would rather pay a higher rate in the interbank lending market, the federal funds market, than the lower rate at the discount window at the Fed. Now, why would they do that? Think about it logically, historically. Do you have a father? Cool. Sweet. Okay, now, imagine you need really, really urgently, I mean seriously, $500. And you've got like scars on your body, you've got the steering wheel of your car in your hand, and you have got what appears to be some of the clothing of a significant other stuffed in your pocket. Now, I am your father. He's your friend. Which would you prefer to go to ask for $500? You know, I'm not going to charge you. I'm not going to charge you interest for it. I'm your dad. Actually, I'm your dad. I'll charge you out the ass. No, I'm your dad. He's going to charge you a high interest rate. Which are you going to go to? You. Me? Let me pull some people. Are you going to go to your dad? You're going to go to your friend. Believe it or not, actually, interestingly enough, some banks would go to their dad. They would go to the Fed. And the Fed would say, "Who's your daddy?" And scare the hell out of them. "What the hell were you doing?" Your friend's not going to say, "What the hell were you doing?" He's going to say, "Dude, let me see those clothes in your pocket." Okay, you follow me? You see the idea, though? Most banks would prefer to borrow from their friends than from Big Daddy Fed. Because Big Daddy Fed's going to want to know why you need the money or something like that. So but some banks actually would, historically. Now, interestingly enough, so in other words, when the Fed sets its discount rate, it doesn't really historically have an effect on the markets. It's a signal. Well, we have raised the discount rate this week at our latest meeting of the Fed. Well, what that would do is signal the market that the Fed would like to see all interest rates come up a bit. Well, we have lowered the discount rate at our recent Fed meeting. Well, that would signal the market that the Fed would like to see all interest rates come down a bit. You see, in this way, knowing that most banks would not actually borrow at the discount window, the discount rate is more of a signal, not an effect in and of itself, but it tells the markets. It says, this is where we are headed. At the recent meeting of the Federal Reserve, the discount rate was held steady. That would tell the markets, well, the Fed seems to feel that the economy is moving right where it should. And so if the Fed thinks that, then we probably would tend to think that too. And we would have more stability in our long-term financial planning, and we would use these kinds of interest rates for our discount rates for our present value of future expected cash flows kinds of things. So you see, it's more of a signal. The Fed cannot set the other rate, that federal funds rate, the rate the banks charge each other, but it can manipulate it. What amazes me is oftentimes in the news after a Fed meeting, the Federal Reserve set the federal funds rate. No, the Federal Reserve cannot set the federal funds rate because the federal funds rate is driven by the supply and demand dynamics of the federal funds market, which is an open free market. But the Fed can affect it. The Fed can set a target for it and then aim monetary policy at that target with the third of the three tools of monetary policy. The third tool is the open market operations, the OMOs. These are done every day. They are like a vast ocean moving across our economy all the time, and only those of us like you, me, in business, finance, economics, in the markets, we know this is going on, but the common person has no clue. I had this one very bright older student, when he was taking my class once quite a while back, he grasped the power of the open market operation. And he just stared, he says, "No one knows about this." Well, it's not no one knows, but only the more educated know that this is going on all the time. This unbelievable ocean of movement of capital, of money. Now, the open market operations are determined by the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC. the FOMC. Now, the voting members of the FOMC, the ones who vote on what's going to happen, how OMOs are going to happen, there would be the seven governors, and then there would be five bank presidents, five of the 12 bank presidents would be the 12 on the of the 12 voting members of the FOMC. Okay, you follow me on that? Now, four of those five Reserve Bank presidents who sit on the FOMC are there on a rotating basis. One's kicked off every 2 years and another one's brought on. It works like that in on a staggering basis. I think it's 2 years. One of them is a permanent voting member of the FOMC. One of the five bank presidents is there forever. That would be the New York bank president. That would be previously Timothy Geithner, who's now our U.S. Treasury Secretary. He had that bank president of the Empire Bank has a permanent seat. He's the only Federal Reserve Bank president who has a permanent seat. The seven governors, of course, they have permanent seats, unless, of course, they die, but that's another thing entirely. So why would the New York, the Empire Bank, have a permanent seat? It has its permanent seat because that's where the domestic trading desk is. The domestic trading desk. Here's how it works. Now this is where you have to do some economics, supply and demand dynamics. But we're almost at the interest rates now. Okay, the FOMC holds a vote. What do we want to do? Do we want to drain liquidity or do we want to add liquidity? Do we want to expand the money supply or do we want to contract the money supply? They make that decision at the level of the FOMC. The 12 governors, now there's more than that in the room as they talk out policy, talk about consequences. They get reports from the heavy-duty industrial strength economists and all that. And the bank presidents who aren't voting members, they have their say. You have fairly lively debates sometimes between the inflation hawks and the stimulus doves and all that kind of stuff. But then when the vote is held, the room clears except for the 12 members. You actually, if you watch that stupid video, you'll actually see very subtly, they show this little cartoon of the all these people talking in the room. And then as soon as they say the vote is held, the room clears and all you see are the 12 people at the table. And the reason is they don't want the markets. They don't want any possibility. They don't want arbitragers to jump in front of them in the open market, knowing what they're about to do and jumping in and stealing the show. That can really screw up the policy if you have these arbitragers go in there and blow your show for you before you get the effect. But anyway, the FOMC makes its decision. Now let's, in this case, I'll start with one where we are where we have been for the past 9 years or so, 8 years, let's say, where we have the Fed adding liquidity to the economy. They want to expand the money supply. They want to create more money. And they're going to do it through the open market operations like this. The FOMC says, we want to pursue expansionary monetary policy. This is articulated to the domestic trading desk in New York, at the New York Fed. Often, now, my understanding is, in the old days, the New York bank president actually carried the orders back to the New York bank. These are the orders, and took them to the desk. Now, when I say the desk, that's more of a conceptual thing. I'm not talking about some solder furniture someone put together. There's a desk, okay? Now, we are going to do expansionary monetary policy. So what that means in practical terms is we are going to add liquidity to the market. We're going to add liquidity to the banking system, specifically. That's a fancy way of saying we're going to dump dollars into the banks. But they're not going to just drive trucks to the banks. They actually did that once, right after 9/11. They just drove trucks to the banks with money. But normally, they're not going to drive trucks to the bank. Here's what they're going to do. Look. A bank is a portfolio of assets. Yes, there's brick and mortar internet banks. I don't know if there is or not. But there's brick and mortar. But a bank is primarily a portfolio of assets. Some of those are highly illiquid, the M3. But let's talk about tier one types of assets. The two primary ones that are in a bank are dollars, actual dollars. Now, these dollars would be in something called the federal funds market. That would be like the depository pool of all the money the banks have. They put it, it's in the federal funds pool, this giant reservoir of the money the banks have. Dollars, cash money. But the other form of highly liquid, very safe asset the banks have, every bit as safe as dollars, every bit as liquid as dollars, is T-bills, literally treasury bills of the U.S. government. The only difference is a bank can't lend a T-bill. Banks cannot lend unless they have money, dollar. They cannot use a T-bill. Have you ever gone to a bank for a loan and been given a T-bill? I can't say that I have either. So the trick is going to be that if the Federal Reserve wants, if the domestic trading desk wants to add liquidity to a banking system, what it's really going to do is tip the balance between the dollars and the T-bills toward the dollars and away from the T-bills. So there's the trick. Now here's how it's going to work. I'm trying to look at someone who would be a respectable, you look like a respectable kind of banker type of person. I'm a Federal Reserve trader. I'm literally a trader for the desk. Now, a trader for the desk has one of the sweetest jobs you would ever want to have. I control a pile of actual money. I don't have a stack of it, but I control a pile of actual money, and I control a pile of T-bills. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to figure out how to get you to sell me some of your T-bills, so that I can pay you with money. You see, I am going to try to flood, I am going to try to flood the market with dollars by demanding T-bills. I am going to surge the demand for T-bills. I'm going to literally, me and a whole bunch of other traders, Fed traders at the desk, we're going to be hammering banks all over. We're just going to be, we need T-bills. We'll buy T-bills. We want T-bills. We love T-bills. Well, I want your T-bills. I'll buy them today. Now, play hard to get with me. I'll pay you $920 for a T-bill. $920. Give me one of your T-bills. I'll pay you. What are you going to play hard to get with me?
No.
Oh, bite me. Fine, $930. Lady, I'm from New York. We kill people on the streets. Fine, 980. You see, my demand, I'm bidding up the price. Other people are demanding them too. We want T-bills. Demand is surging. Okay, here we go. What's happening is that the Fed is driving. Here's the supply of T-bills in the market. Here's the demand for T-bills. And here's the price of T-bills. And here's the quantity of T-bills. Now, the demand for T-bills is surging to from D1 to D2. By supply and demand dynamics, that pushes the price from P1 to P2, right? Okay, are we okay on that? Demand goes up. Now, remember what I taught you last week? If the price of a T-bill goes up, what happens to the yield of the T-bill? Oh, I love it when you talk like that, yes. They're driving the yields on T-bills down. They're literally, by this howling demand that the Fed's desk, that the domestic trading desk can do, they drive the prices of the T-bills up in the open market, and that pushes the yields on T-bills down. So the price of the T-bills goes up, which induces the yield on the T-bills to drop. So there is, but wait, there's more. That's not the only way that the interest rates are going down. Do you see how they are actually suppressing interest rates that way? But they are also creating a secondary effect. Because finally, this person sold me some T-bills. Fine. Well, okay, I'll pay you now. So what will happen here is that the desk, what I will do is you will send me some T-bills and I will send you some dollars. Now what that will do is that those dollars are actually sitting in this giant pool called the federal funds market. But the federal funds market is where the supply of lendable funds is. So there are the lendable funds right there in that. Now the price of those lendable funds is the interest rate charged on them, the Fed funds rate. Okay, so what's happening in that market is you have the demand for lendable funds from banks and businesses and people, and you have the supply of lendable funds here. But now we are saying that more money is going into the Fed funds market, which should surge the supply outward, which should push interest rates down. Two rounds, a double punch. Yields on T-bills fall, and the rates on the federal funds rate slides, which means that the banks are borrowing from each other at lower rates, which means that they're probably also going to be lending to businesses and people at lower rates. You got the trick? And it happens every day, all the time. This is the open market operations on the adding liquidity side. But here's the downside. Here's the downside of it. You can't play games with the liquidity forever. An economy needs a certain amount of money to conduct transactions. If too much money is there, the value of each unit of the money, in this case dollars, waters down. That's a fancy way of saying inflation happens. If there's not enough money, then the value of each dollar rises. That's a fancy way of saying deflation. We do not want inflations and deflations. The Federal Reserve's exclusive goal of monetary policy is stability of the aggregate price level. That's its job. It's not there to help the economy. It's not there to hurt the economy. It's not there to stimulate when there's a recession. And it's sure as hell not there, the way it was under Alan Greenspan, to try to kill the economy to create a recession in 2000 so that his choice for president would become the real president. That's exactly what he did. And it's not the first time in Fed history they've pulled that stunt. Oh, God, this temple. However, taking that aside, we do not want inflations. Inflations are nasty. They can get to be like fevers. The fever gets worse and you start feeling worse. You know, when you got a fever about maybe 99, 99.5, people think he's hot. Okay, he's warm. But when the fever gets up to like about 102, 103, you really begin to feel crappy. That's what an inflation is. An inflation is like a fever. And eventually it begins to affect our financial decisions. We start shortening our time horizons, pulling back like this. We can't predict too far out. We start demanding more and more just because of inflation, not because of any real reward factor. On the other hand, deflations. In the world, as bad as inflations are, I can guarantee you that almost every decent finance and economics jockey in the world wants to stay on the other side of the universe from a deflation. They are horrible. We had one in the 1930s. We had a couple of rounds of it. It is nasty. Scariest thing is, over the past year or so, we've had evidence of deflation at the consumer goods level. The CPI has been negative several times. It's scary. Why? Because the Federal Reserve was choking M1. Look at my chart. You can see it. It's as plain as day. They were throttling M1. So we had deflationary pressures happening. At the same time, the Fed was swilling the market with highly illiquid money. So you have both effects going on. Short term, some deflation, but in the long term, inflation. Sooner or later, we'll have to deal with it. Whether or not Ben Bernanke is the most spineless human being that has ever walked the face of the earth, short of a Democrat, he will have to deal with it. And if he doesn't, someone will. So here's the other side of the story. How does the contractionary monetary policy work? Someday, in the next 2-3 years, they're going to say, "Ruh-roh, we've got inflation. We have got to claw in that money supply. We have got to execute contractionary monetary policy." As the economists at the Federal Reserve in St. Louis said 2 years ago, scared to death to actually tell the truth because that's the way it's been so politicized in the Fed. They said, "Well, we're going to have to eventually deliquify the economy." Deliquify? Where the hell did you get that term? Deliquify? Are you talking about contractionary monetary policy? Well, we don't like to call it contract. You're going to have to contract. Okay, the FOMC finally gets its spine and says, contract, draw in, claw in all that money that's been building for the last 8, 9, 10 years. Here we go. We're back to the bank again. I'm the trader. You're the banker. How am I going to do this with you? I'm going to say, all right, there's a bank here. This bank now has just boatloads of dollars. And of course, the bank does have some T-bills. The bank's not stupid. It's going to go and buy T-bills because the prices are going up. See how the Fed is driving the price of T-bills up? You're crazy if you don't take some of that money I paid you and run right to the Fed auction, the Treasury auction, and buy some more T-bills. Because I'm going to be back to buy some more from you later if it's expansionary monetary policy. See how I can make you rich doing this? It's a scam. I can do it to you over and over. We can do this together over and over. You sell me your T-bills. I give you money. You run to the Treasury auctions where the prices are skyrocketing. You make money off them. I buy them back from you at inflated prices. You see how it works? And I can make you profit this way. So we've been working on it. Okay, now I've got to deal with this. You got some T-bills. What I need to do is this time I need to sell you T-bills. I need to drain liquidity. Look, I've got to sell you a T-bill. How about 980? Play hard to get with me. I'll sell you a T-bill for 980.
No.
Well, bite me. Give me a price. What price? Come on. What price?
900.
Lady, my arm! Ow! God, I love it. My ancestry is Jewish. This brings out good feelings in me. It does. Okay, good. Do you see what she's doing? She's driving me down in price. Okay, let's talk about technically. What's happening? She is going to try to sell me T-bills. And if she sells me a T-bill, I'm going to try to sell her a T-bill. I'm sorry. If I try to sell you a T-bill, well, that means that you'll have to pay me with money. So you'll pull money out of the Fed funds market to pay me. And I will send you a T-bill. Technically, what's happening in the T-bill market is that we had the supply and demand. Now I'm demanding T-bills. I'm flooding the market with T-bills. I'm trying to pump them into the market. I'm pouring them out. So the supply of T-bills pours out. As the supply of T-bills hitting the banks goes up, surges outward, the price of T-bills goes down. But if the price of the T-bills is going down, what's happening to the yield on T-bills? I'll spank me Jesus. Driving yields up. I'm making interest rates go up. I'm slowing down the economy. But now let's all talk about the Fed funds market. Here is the lendable funds market. There's a demand for lendable funds, and here's the supply of lendable funds. Here's the price of lendable funds, the interest rate, the Fed funds rate. Okay, now, if you are paying me with money to buy T-bills from me, that should be contracting the supply of lendable funds because money's disappearing. That you used to be able to lend, now you've bought T-bills with it. So the supply kicks inward like that, driving interest rates on loans up. Again, boom, boom. You got the Treasury bill yield effect, bam. And then you get the federal funds rate effect, bam again. You've got the interest rates rising, money being clawed out of the economy. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.